Applause was thin and scattered. Ebenezer Fraser, watching from the shelter of the wings in the shadow of ropes and sandbags, felt his heart sink. But at least it was over. She was leaving the podium to join him. Fraser opened the nickeled catches of her ladyship's travelling bag. Lady Ada dropped her manuscript within it, followed it with her kid gloves and her tiny ribboned hat.
"I think they understood me," she said brightly. "It sounds quite elegant in French, Mr. Fraser, does it not? A very rational language, French."
"What next, milady? The hotel?"
"My dressing room," she said. "The heat is rather fatiguing. Will you hail the gurney for me? I'll join you presently."
"Certainly, milady."
Fraser, the bag in one hand, his sword cane in another, led Lady Ada to the cramped little dressing room, opened the door, bowed her within, set her bag at her neatly slippered feet, and closed the door firmly. Within the room, he knew, her ladyship would seek the consolation of the silvered brandy flask she had hidden in the left-hand lower drawer of her dressing table, wrapped with pathetic duplicity in a shroud of tissue paper. Fraser had taken the liberty of providing seltzer water in a bucket of ice. He hoped she would water the liquor a bit. He left the lecture hall by a rear door, then circled the building warily from old habit. His bad eye ached below the patch, and he made some use of the stag-handled sword cane. As he had fully expected, he saw nothing resembling trouble. There was also no sign of the chauffeur for her ladyship's hired gurney. Doubtless the frog rascal was nursing a bottle somewhere, or chatting up a soubrette. Or he might perhaps have mistaken his instructions, for Fraser's French was none of the best. He rubbed his good eye, examining the traffic. He would give the fellow 20 minutes, then hail a cab. He saw her ladyship standing, rather uncertainly, at the lecture hall's rear door. She had put on a day bonnet, it seemed, and forgotten her travelling bag, which was very like her. He hurried, limping, to her side.
"This way, milady. The gurney will meet us at the corner."
He paused. It was not Lady Ada.
"I believe you mistake me, sir," the woman said in English, and lowered her eyes and smiled. "I am not your queen of engines. I am merely an admirer."
"I beg your pardon, madame," Fraser said.
The woman glanced down shyly at the intricate jacquard patterning of her white-on-white skirt of fine muslin. She wore a jutting French bustle and a stiff, high-shouldered walking jacket trimmed with lace.
"Her ladyship and I are dressed quite alike," she said with a wry half-smile. "Her ladyship must shop at Monsieur Worth's. That's quite a tribute to my own taste, sir, n'est-ce pas?"
Fraser said nothing. A light tingle of suspicion touched him. The woman, a trim little blonde in her 40s, perhaps, wore the dress of respectability, yet there were 3 gold-banded brilliants on her gloved fingers, and showy little stems of filigreed jade dangled at her delicate earlobes. There was a killing beauty patch, or a black sticking plaster, at the corner of her mouth, and her wide blue eyes, for all their look of seasoned innocence, held the gleam of the demi-mondaine, a look that somehow said, "I know you, copper."
"Sir, may I wait for her ladyship with you? I hope I will not intrude if I request her autograph."
"At the corner," Fraser nodded. "The gurney."
He offered her his left arm, tucked the sword cane in the pit of his right, his hand resting easy on the handle. It would not hurt to get a bit of distance down the pavement before Lady Ada approached. He wanted to watch this woman. They stopped at the corner, beneath an angular French gas lamp.
"It's so good to hear a London voice," said the woman coaxingly. "I have lived so long in France that my English has grown quite rusty."
"Not at all," Fraser said. Her voice was lovely.
"I am Madame Tournachon," she said. "Sybil Tournachon."
"My name is Fraser," he bowed.
Sybil Tournachon fidgeted with her kid-skin gloves, as though her palms were perspiring. The day was very hot.
"Are you one of her paladins, Mr. Fraser?"
"I'm afraid I fail to take your meaning, madame," Fraser said politely. "Do you live in Paris, Mrs. Tournachon?"
"In Cherbourg," she said, "but I came all that way by the morning express simply to see her speak." She paused. I scarcely understood a word she said.
"No harm in that, madame," Fraser said. "Neither do I."
He had begun to like her. The gurney arrived. The chauffeur, with a bold wink at Fraser, hopped from behind the wheel and whipped a dirty chamois from his pocket. He applied it to the tarnished trim of a scalloped fender, whistling. Her ladyship emerged from the lecture hall. She had remembered her handbag. As she approached, Mrs. Tournechamp went a bit pale with excitement and took a lecture programme from her jacket. She was quite harmless.
"Your ladyship, may I present Mrs. Sybil Tournechamp?" Fraser said.
"How do you do?" Lady Ada said.
Mrs. Tournechamp curtsied.
"Will you sign my programme, please?"
Lady Ada blinked. Fraser adroitly handed her the pen from his notebook.
"Of course,"
Lady Ada said, taking the paper.
"I'm sorry. What was the name?" "To Sybil Tournechamp. Shall I spell it?" "No need," said her ladyship, smiling. "There's a famous French aeronaut named Tournechamp, isn't there?"
Fraser offered his back to the flourish of her ladyship's pen.
"A relation of yours, perhaps?" "No, Your Highness."
"I beg your pardon,"
Lady Ada said.
"They call you Queen of Engines."
Mrs. Tournechamp smiled triumphantly, plucked the inscribed programme from her ladyship's unresisting fingers.
"The Queen of Engines. And you're just a funny little grey-haired blue stocking," she laughed. "This lecture gull you're running, dearie, does it pay at all well? I do hope it pays."
Lady Ada regarded her with unfeigned astonishment. Fraser's grip tightened on the cane. He stepped to the curb, swiftly opened the gurney door.
"One moment."
The woman tugged with sudden energy at one gloved finger, came up with a gaudy ring.
"Your ladyship, please, I want you to have this."
Fraser stepped between them, lowering the cane.
"Leave her alone."
"No," Mrs. Tournechamp cried. "I've heard the tales. I know she needs it."
She pressed against him, stretching out her arm.
"Your ladyship, please take this. I shouldn't have wounded your feelings. It was low of me. Please take my gift. Please, I do admire you. I sat through that whole lecture. Please take it. I bought it just for you."
She fell back then, her hand empty, and smiled.
"Thank you, Your Ladyship. Good luck to you. I shan't trouble you again. Au revoir. Bonne chance."
Fraser followed her ladyship into the gurney, shut the door, rapped the partition. The chauffeur took his post. The gurney pulled away.
"What a queer little personage," her ladyship said.
She opened her hand. A fat little diamond gleamed in its filigreed setting.
"Who was she, Mr. Fraser?"
"Oh, I shall guess an exile, ma'am," Fraser said. "Very forward of her."
"Was it wrong of me to take this?"
Her breath smelled of brandy and seltzer.
"Not really proper, I suppose. But she would have made a scene otherwise."
She held the gem up in a sheet of dusty sunlight through the window.
"Look at the size of it. It must be very dear."
"Paste, Your Ladyship."
Swift as thought, Lady Ada pinched the ring in her fingers like a bit of chalk and ran the stone along the gurney's window. There was a thin, grating shriek, almost inaudible, and a shining groove appeared across the glass. They sat in companionable silence then on their way to the hotel. Fraser watched Paris through the window and recalled his instructions.
"You may let the old girl drink as she likes," the hierarch had told him, with his inimitable air of mincing irony. "Talk as she likes, flirt as she likes, saving open scandal, of course. You may take your mission as fulfilled if you can keep our little Ada from the wagering machines."
There had been small chance of that disaster, for her purse held nothing but tickets and small change. But the diamond had rather changed matters. He would have to keep a closer eye now. Their rooms in the Richelieu were quite modest, with a connecting door he had not touched. The locks were sound enough, and he had found and plugged the inevitable spy holes. He kept the keys.
"Is there anything left of the advance?"
Lady Ada asked.
"Enough to tip the chauffeur," Fraser said.
"Oh, dear, that little?"
Fraser nodded. The French savants had paid little enough for the pleasure of her learned company, and her debts had swiftly eaten that. The meagre takings at the ticket booth would scarcely have paid their passage from London. Lady Ada opened the curtains, frowned at summer daylight, closed them again.
"Then I suppose I shall have to take on that tour in America."
Fraser sighed, inaudibly.
"They say that continent boasts many natural wonders, m'lady."
"Which tour, though? Boston and New Philadelphia, or Charleston and Richmond?"
Fraser said nothing. The names of the alien cities struck him with a leaden gloom.
"I shall toss a coin for it,"
her ladyship decided brightly. "Have you a coin, Mr. Fraser?"
"No, m'lady,"
Fraser lied, searching his pockets with a muted jingle.
"I'm sorry."
"Don't they pay you at all?"
her ladyship inquired with a hint of temper.
"I have my police pension, m'lady. Quite generous, promptly paid."
The promptness part was true, at least.
She was concerned now, hurt.
"But doesn't the society pay you a proper salary? Oh, dear, and I've put you to so much trouble, Mr. Fraser. I had no idea."
"They recompense me in their own way, ma'am. I am well rewarded."
He was her paladin. It was more than enough. She stepped to her bureau, searching among papers and receipts. Her fingers touched the tortoise-shell handle of her travelling mirror. She turned then and caught him with a woman's look. Under its pressure he lifted his hand, quite without volition, and touched his bumpy cheek below the eye-patch. His white side-whiskers did not hide the scars. A shotgun had caught him there. It still ached sometimes when it rained. She did not see his gesture, though, or did not choose to see it. She beckoned him nearer.
"Mr. Fraser, my friend, tell me something, won't you? Tell me the truth," she sighed. "Am I nothing but a funny little grey-haired blue stocking?"
"Madame," Fraser said gently, "you are la reine des ordinateurs."
"Am I?"
She lifted the mirror, gazed within it. In the mirror, a city. It is 1991. It is London. 10,000 towers, the cyclonic hum of a trillion twisting gears, all air gone earthquake dark in a mist of oil, in the frictioned heat of intermeshing wheels. Black, seamless pavements, uncounted tributary rivulets for the frantic travels of the punched-out lace of data, the ghosts of history loosed in this hot, shining necropolis. Paper-thin faces below like sails, twisting, yawning, tumbling through the empty streets, human faces that are borrowed masks and lenses for a peering eye. And when a given face has served its purpose, it crumbles, frail as ash, bursting into a dry foam of data, its constituent bits and motes. But new fabrics of conjecture are knitted in the city's shining cores, swift, tireless spindles flinging off invisible loops in their millions, while in the hot, unhuman dark, data melts and mingles, churned by gearwork to a skeletal bubbling pumice, dipped in a dreaming wax that forms a simulated flesh, perfect as thought. It is not London, but mirrored plazas of sheerest crystal, the avenues atomic lightning, the sky a supercooled gas, as the eye chases its own gaze through the labyrinth, leaping quantum gaps that are causation, contingency, chance. Electric phantoms are flung into being, examined, dissected, infinitely iterated. In this city's centre, a thing grows. An autocatalytic tree in almost life, feeding through the roots of thought on the rich decay of its own shed images, and ramifying through myriad lightning branches up, up, toward the hidden light of vision. Dying to be born. The light is strong. The light is clear. The eye at last must see itself. Myself. I see. I see, I see, I. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Difference Engine by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. Copyright 1991 by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. Performed by Simon Vance. Performance copyright 2010 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.